So it's a pleasure to be here. Many thanks to my hosts for the invitation, the opportunity to come and speak to you today. I am an experimentalist, so please bear with me. My topic today is shown here. This is the heart of our detector, the IceCube Neutrino Observatory. Everyone associates this image at the surface with IceCube. That's our counting house, which sits about a kilometer away from the barbershop pole at South Pole Station, Antarctica. And my title today is Neutrino Hunting in the Antarctic, and I think that'll hopefully become clear as I move through the discussion today. So I start right at the very beginning, almost 100 years ago. What was happening is that people were studying with higher and higher precision measurements of radioactive decay. And one of the processes that they were studying quite carefully was the beta decay process, where you have a massive atom. It's made up of protons and neutrons. The neutrons can go through a beta decay process where you essentially convert the neutron into a proton and you emit a beta particle in that reaction. Now, what was happening is that this process is quite prolific. They were measuring this with very high precision, and things weren't adding up. And so what you have are the proton and the beta and the rest mass of the neutron. When you measure the energies of the outgoing particles, they didn't add up to that rest mass. And so what you have is a dilemma with breaking the conservation of energy, one of our fundamental laws. So enter Wolfgang Pauli, 1930. Fantastic photo of a young Wolfgang Pauli. And what he does is he suggests at a conference in a letter to the attendees, dear radioactive ladies and gentlemen, a brand new particle. And that particle proposal, that hypothesis, is really quite bold. He has the fundamental properties of the particle, that it's electrically neutral, it's spin 1/2. And he goes on to suggest that it's being emitted, in addition to the electrons, the beta particles and the protons in that beta decay process. He goes further, saying that they're extremely light and neutral. He calls them the neutron, and that they're simply escaping the experiments without detection. And that really seems quite strange when you think about it at that era, that you would suggest that a particle could do such a thing. Enter a year later, Enrico Fermi, who takes this idea and starts to develop the first full model that describes this process that you see here, that now includes the antineutrino of the electron being emitted in that process. 3 years later, he develops the full theoretical model for the beta decay process, and the neutrino is ultimately born as a theoretical postulation in that era. Now, neutrinos from that point forward have been really quite a remarkable particle to study. In the 1950s, we had the very first detection of neutrinos at a nuclear reactor. The neutrino started to get the nickname of the ghost particle due to its ability to escape the detectors without notice. So this Hannaford reactor experiment was nicknamed Project Poltergeist, really quite appropriately. And so they will have, that's Rhines and Cowan, they will have the very first measurements of neutrinos at that nuclear reactor. A decade later, what you have are a number of neutrino discoveries that are taking forward, and the images that you see here, the first image is the measurement that's made of the first muon neutrinos at an accelerator, a cyclotron accelerator. You have the first measurements in a deep mine of atmospheric neutrinos. And in another deep mine in the US, you have Ray Davis standing over multiple tons of cleaning fluid to measure solar neutrinos for the first time. Each of these, this and this, results in a Nobel Prize. It's really quite amazing. It progresses from that point forward into the 1980s, where the detectors really start to become quite large, harnessing what's called the Cherenkov effect to measure the neutrino signals that are occurring in very rare instances. And so this is an image It's like an amusement park ride where you can basically paddle a boat through a region that is supposed to mimic the Cameo Kande detector that was existing in the 1980s. Cameo Kande made the first measurement of neutrinos from a supernova burst, 1987A. And so that was recorded at that point in time. And they shared the Nobel Prize with Ray Davis in the early 2000s. And then you have the 1990s, where things really started to become big. The multi-kiloton scale, and you can see the 50-kiloton detector of Super Cameo Kande. That's a boat with some people in it. And so it's really quite a massive, impressive detector, technological feat. And then one of my favorite photos ever, this is the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory, just before we were closing up the photomultiplier tubes that surround the acrylic vessel where the target medium was located. And so this brings us through a quite rich history. There are Nobel Prizes littered throughout this period of studying neutrinos. And in the present day, the neutrino is a fundamental part of the standard model of particle physics. It's a cornerstone. It shares that corner with its charged partners of the leptons in that family. And so you have three active neutrinos that we know of, electron, muon, and tau. These mirror the charged partners of the leptons, electron, muon, and tau types. And from the lines, you can see how you connect back with the force carriers in nature. And so the neutrinos actually only interact via the weak bosons in this structure. And so they only interact in nature via the weak force. And this is really quite remarkable. They're the only particle that we know of at this point in time that actually does that. And so if you take a quick survey of where we are, they're second in abundance to photons in the universe in total number, density. They do have three active flavors, and we have produced them and detected them directly in accelerator experiments, as well as those that arrive to us in nature itself through natural means. And we've learned quite a lot in 80 years when you think about how difficult it is to study this particle. It took us about 80 years to figure out that they are not massless, that they do have some mass. That was discovered through the fact that they actually mix. They change flavor or they oscillate as they propagate in nature. And this was the breakthrough measurement where Super K and Snow shared the Nobel Prize in 2015. But because of the challenges in actually making the detection and studying the properties of this neutrino, many of those remain a mystery. And I list a number of these here. It is not a fully inclusive list. But I start out by the fact that the neutrino oscillations, they do imply mass. This is the first evidence for physics beyond the standard model. And so the number of unknowns that we have are the following. We still don't know the absolute mass scale of the neutrino, where how far it is above zero, for instance. We don't know the ordering of the neutrino masses in that mass scale, meaning that we don't actually know which is the heaviest or the lightest neutrino in nature, whether it's the electron, the muon, or the tau, and that's known as the mass ordering or the mass hierarchy problem. The particle nature of the neutrino, we don't know if they're their own antiparticle, if they follow a Majorana or a Dirac formulation in nature. Charge parity is really quite intriguing in the leptonic sector. This would be associated with the neutrinos. And those neutrino properties, if you do have charge parity violation at a large scale in that sector, you do have the ability to nearly fully explain the matter-antimatter asymmetry that we see in the universe. And on the flip side of this, not just looking at the neutrino itself, you can ask the question, what can I do with neutrinos in their study? And it turns out that the neutrino may actually be an ideal messenger, and this will be the focus of the remainder of my talk. In particular, they hold the ability, we believe, to unlock more than 100-year mystery of the origin of the high-energy cosmic rays that we observe showering the Earth in basically constant bombardment from space, and then studying the behavior of the most violent astrophysical processes in the universe. And ultimately, they may help us unlock what is the dark matter in nature. And so the remainder of my talk will focus on these two elements that you see here highlighted in green. We'll explore how we can look at the origin of cosmic rays using neutrinos and how those are locked or how they're linked directly back to the astrophysical processes that are producing these. So we take a step forward for the cosmic rays. And they were first measured in 1912, so just over 100 years ago. That measurement was made by Victor Hess. He performed a ballooning experiment where he went up several kilometers measuring the radiation that with a very sensitive device as a function of height. And what he saw was really quite unexpected. He saw the radiation increase as he moved away from the Earth. That is not what was predicted. And so this was the very first measurement of the cosmic ray spectrum. And those cosmic rays are charged particles. That's one of the great challenges in trying to identify the sources that are accelerating the cosmic rays. You can see the spectrum that has been measured with exquisite precision over a very long history. This is normalized to an e to the 2 power spectrum. And so if you had an e to the 2 spectrum, it would be flat in this projection, and this is versus energy. And you can see listed along the energy scale the equivalent fixed target energies for the accelerators, the leading accelerators that we've created on the planet so far. The LHC files here, many orders of magnitude above that, you have the cosmic ray spectrum continuing in nature. And so they project out to the most extreme energies that that you can imagine ultimately creating in nature. And so the open questions still remain: what are the astrophysical sources that are accelerating these particles? And then once you identify those sources, how are they actually being accelerated in those regions? And so we enter a new era to try and answer these questions, and that's known as multi-messenger astronomy. And it's really quite a simple premise. What you do is you take your favorite astrophysical objects, which are accelerating particles to very high energies, in particular protons, and those protons will interact nearby. And when they do so, you get a shower of particles produced. The protons can produce gamma rays, and they can produce neutrinos in that shower of activity that you have close to the source. Now, the key here for multi-messenger astronomy is you want to put the information from all of these different types of messengers together to get the most information that you possibly can from what's happening at the source. So you have photons, you have the gamma rays that are being produced, and they are an excellent messenger. They are produced, they come to you essentially straight from the source. There's two challenges here. If you put a heavy dust cloud, for instance, in front of them, they do have a high probability of being absorbed. And as you reach approximately 30 TeV in energy, the gamma rays that you're producing will interact with the gamma rays of the infrared background in the universe. They will pair produce E plus E minus and ultimately be absorbed in that process. So you lose the information from the gamma ray spectrum above about 30 TeV. That's shown here. The protons, these are ultimately the cosmic rays. They do reach you at the most extreme energies. These are the cosmic ray energies at the tail of the distribution that I showed you in the previous two slides ago. The challenge here is that there are very large magnetic fields in the galaxies. Those magnetic fields permeate the space as the protons are passing through. Because they're charged, they get wrapped up in those magnetic fields. You lose your directional information. And so you get exquisite measurements of the energy spectrum of those particles, but you actually can't point back to where they were produced. Now, the neutrino over the entire energy spectrum, they are not expected. They should not be absorbed. They should be coming to us directly from where they are produced. The challenge here, of course, is their detection. You have to build special detectors that would allow you to look back and actually measure these rare processes that would occur. And so in the energy spectrum, which you have, our neutrino particle physics, which occurs at the lower end where you are making measurements of these neutrino properties. And then once you get above about 30 TeV, where the gamma ray energies are cutting off, you enter a regime where you can actually perform neutrino astrophysics, looking for the signal to start to emerge from the common backgrounds that ultimately would dominate your detector. So the potential sources that you have for these astrophysical neutrinos are shown in the following, and I'll just go through them quite quickly in order. Through proton-proton interactions near the source itself, either in active galactic nuclei, gamma ray bursts, starburst galaxies, et cetera, you can produce the neutrinos by producing, for instance, pions in the local region. Those pions will decay, and that's ultimately where you get your neutrinos from. They escape that local region and bring the information from their production directly to the detector. You can have the proton interacting on the cosmic microwave background once you get high enough in energy. This is known as the GZK cutoff, where once you're above a few 10 to the 19, you can see this downturn in the cosmic ray flux. This is fully observed. It's well measured in the proton signature, and so you're losing those protons through that interaction. You end up with a delta resonance, and then again you can produce neutrinos in that resonance interaction which occurs. Quite intriguing, you may be able to see dark matter interactions that are occurring out in the universe. Dark matter is expected to clump in gravitational wells of massive bodies, including the sun and the earth. And so you can look back at these sources for high energy neutrinos from the dark matter either annihilating or decaying in those local regions. And so you're looking for high energy neutrinos coming from sources where they should not arise. And finally, the cosmic rays interacting in our atmosphere produces a beautiful spectrum of high energy atmospheric neutrinos, where at the lower energies you can do exquisite measurements of neutrino properties, including oscillations. And then at the higher energies, you can look for the flux of these neutrinos. And what you're ultimately looking for from the astrophysical source is for this spectrum to basically carry forward from this energy onward. So the atmospheric neutrinos at a few TeV are your background. As you move onward, the spectrum falls down, and essentially you have a bump that carries outward from that as you go up in energy. And so this is the search that you ultimately perform. Now, the principles of the neutrino detection are the following. These are the technologies that are leading the field. There's Watershenkov detectors, where you're looking for the emission of a charged particle that exceeds the speed of light in the medium that you're studying. And so this is the primary interaction that I'll discuss for the remainder of the talk. But you can also take approaches in radio, in Escherichov measurements, and then you can also use acoustic technologies to look for these signatures. The Watershenkov is the following. What you do is you choose a transparent medium that you instrument with optical sensors. The neutrino interacts, and when it interacts, you produce a charged lepton of the same flavor, of the same family and flavor, and then that charged particle will travel through your medium. It exceeds the speed of light in the medium, and you emit blue radiation, essentially, that you can detect with your photosensors that are distributed here. Okay, so when you do that, you are sensitive to all three neutrino types, and what you do is you look at the shape of the light that you have in your detector. And so if you distribute optical sensors throughout your detector medium, there are three primary shapes that you observe. The first is a track shape. So this is actually an upward going muon neutrino from the Ice Cube detector. Each of the dots that you see here is a photomultiplier tube in our detector that's in our detector itself, which has observed a photon as the charged particle is moved through. The colors mean something. Red is early, blue is late. So the muon entered from the bottom of our detector and exited through the top. The size of the sphere, that's how much charge we measured in the detector at that local region as the particle was traversing through. And so for the muon neutrinos, the muons give up their energy very slowly. And so you end up with this exquisite track that basically can traverse many kilometers in the detector medium that you're detecting. So you have an excellent handle on the direction here. You end up with a kilometer or more lever arm to reconstruct back the direction of the neutrino as it moved through your detector. And so that allows you to target sub-degree angular resolutions to basically point back in the sky for where the neutrino originated. The challenge with these events is that they can enter and exit, depositing energy outside, lots of energy outside of your detector. And so you lose energy resolution in such an event. The next type is the electron neutrino and the neutral current interaction that can occur. When you produce an electron, the electrons love to give up their energy through the electromagnetic process. These are called cascade events. What happens is that as the electron loses its energy in the local region, the light basically is emitted in that shower that occurs, and then it just moves outward. And it looks like a fuzzy sphere of light in your detector. Again, red is early, blue is late, so the interaction occurred basically here, contained within our detector, and then you can see the light move out from there. Now, these events are basically the ante of the track event. When you try and reconstruct the direction of a fuzzy sphere, it turns out it's challenging, and the angular resolution is far less precise than what you have with your track-like events. On the other hand, the events, because the detector is so large, the events can be highly contained. And so you get really excellent energy resolution for these events. And so these types of events allow you to study the energy spectrum of the high energy neutrinos with very good precision. And so when you look back at the physics that you might want to do, these are the events that you ultimately use to do astronomy, because you can point. And these are the events that you ultimately chase your fundamental physics questions with, because you have the information, the excellent information on the energy that the event had. Now, the third type of neutrino, active neutrino, is the tau neutrino. And we have a golden signature for this. Again, red is early in time, blue, green is late. And so what you have here is the tau neutrino enters, it has an interaction, and you get a hadronic shower at that interaction point. You produce a tau, which decays very quickly. So at these energy, it travels 50 to a few hundred meters in the detector, so still fully contained. And then it decays, and you get another hadronic shower in that decay. And so this looks like what we call a double bang in the detector. In a single detector event, you'll see basically two cascades in the detector separated by some distance related to the energy of the tau neutrino. When you put all three of these signatures together, this is how you develop the scientific program for the observatory. Now, there's a global program of Watershcherenkov-based detectors that are trying to make the measurements of the ultra-high energy neutrinos from the universe. And I show them quickly here. There's Antares, which is currently running in the Mediterranean Sea. And then the upgrade to that is called KM3Net. There's two detectors, one located off of the coast of Italy and one off of the coast of France, shown in the two locations here. And they ultimately are under construction now. Their goal is to achieve something on the order of a cubic kilometer detector. There's a detector under construction in Russia at Lake Baikal. It's called GVD. And again, it's a deep water detector, and it's aiming for, again, a cubic kilometer. And for the last decade, we have IceCube, which is at South Pole Station, in the deep ice that's located there. And we're, as you'll see, we're starting to move forward with a new generation for this detector. But the cubic kilometer detector has been in full operation since 2011. Now, when you go to the South Pole a few years ago, this is what you see, and this is what we're aiming for in the future. There's this long skiway. This is where Hercules aircraft will land, bringing people and supplies. This is South Pole Station located here. The barbershop pole is approximately right there. This is the ice cube drill camp. And in the opening photo, this is the location of the counting house for ice cube. As you look at the detector itself, we completed it late in 2010. This is during the summer season at South Pole Station. And you can see from the points from the photo, this is the skiway that I showed you there. This is the station itself. The counting house is located here. It's a hybrid observatory. You have a surface detector that basically covers the deep detector that you see here. That surface array is called IceTop, and it's designed to measure high energy cosmic rays that are showering from above the ice cube detector. The actual ice cube detector is shown here. It's more than a cubic kilometer of the deep glacial ice. The distance from the surface to the top of the detector array is about a kilometer and a half. And then this height here is a kilometer. The Eiffel Tower is here for scale. And then you have a dense array called Deep Core. The ice cube array is what we use to look at high energy neutrino interactions from astrophysical sources. And Deep Core, the dense array, is where we perform our neutrino property measurements through oscillation measurements of atmospheric neutrinos. This is the outline. So if I zoom in on the photo that I had before, the South Pole Station was under construction at that point in time when we were doing construction of the ice cube detector. This is the outline of the ice cube detector over basically a square kilometer of the glacier. And you can see all the way to the horizon. It's a very uninteresting place to visit. This is the drill camp. As we zoom in further, there's a person here for scale beside this hose reel. What you see are these red trailers. This is these are some of the world's most efficient hot water heaters. So what we do is we take fuel off of the Hercules aircraft, jet fuel. We put them into hot water heaters, and we make boiling water out of the glacier in the local region at South Pole Station. That hot water passes through this hose and into a hot water drill. These trailers are essentially producing about 5 megawatts of power on the surface, and we take all of that power in hot water, we concentrate it into a quarter inch nozzle, and we point that into the glacier. When you do that, you melt your way into the glacier. You create, in the design, we create a half meter diameter hole, 2.5 kilometers deep, and we can melt that in under a day. That hole stays liquid for about a day. And while it's liquid, what we do is we have our photo detectors. We attach them to copper lines, and we lower them into that liquid hole. And then we allow them to refreeze into the glacier, and they're there essentially forever. And so to create your detector, you melt a hole. While the hole is liquid, you take one of your photosensors, you attach it to a copper cable, you lower it a specific distance for the energy scale that you're targeting in that part of the detector, and then you attach another module. You do that 60 times for every hole, and you then lower all of these 60 modules down 2.5 kilometers into the glacier. And you repeat this 86 times over a 7-year period, and that's how you achieve ice cube at the end of the day.
So there's no repairing anything, right, Dave? What's your failure rate?
There is no repairs. So failure rate is about 1 every 2 years. So they're designed to satellite spec for the survival in the glacier. Yeah. So over the entire course of the experiment since we started taking data in 2006. I think we've lost like 50 in total. Okay. The detector itself is really quite, it's beautiful in its simplicity. It's simply a 10-inch photomultiplier tube at the bottom of the object that you see here, which is called a digital optical module. Photomultiplier tubes, as you probably realize, are really quite fragile devices. So what we do is we encapsulate them in a glass pressure housing, which is about a centimeter thick. And then we have the full data acquisition and power on board. So it's a completely autonomous module once you deploy it in the ice. The only thing that I have to do is send low voltage down that copper line, and I bring my digitized waveform from the photomultiplier tube up on the copper line, and I send that by satellite to do my data analysis for what was observed by that instrument. And there are 5,000 of these distributed across the cubic kilometer in the deep glacier. Okay, so the way that it works, neutrino here is red, and this is a water molecule, Eiffel Tower for scale. Of course, these aren't correct. thankfully, yeah. And so what you have the neutrino interaction, you have the blue Cherenkov light that's produced. And then every photomultiplier tube that sees light as that particle passes through, you detect that light. And then you can use your data algorithms to extract the event and identify that it was a track passing through the detector just based on timing. And then the topology of the event tells you what type it was, where it came from, the amount of energy that's deposited as it passes through. When you put all of that information together, this is the science program that you can target. And we described this briefly before. These are the sources that I mentioned for the astrophysical neutrinos that you would expect. Dark matter, including, we're very sensitive to supernovae events. We haven't seen one yet, unfortunately. Still waiting since 1987, but it'll come eventually. Atmospheric neutrinos, very sensitive limits to exotic particles beyond the standard model searches. And believe it or not, when you melt your way an instrument a cubic kilometer of the deep glacier at the South Pole, glaciologists actually want to see your data. Okay, we see how the glacier is evolving at the deepest scale at that location on the Antarctic continent, and it's information that they didn't have previously. Okay, so I will focus the rest of my talk on accelerators, proton accelerators, sources of cosmic rays, and then the diffuse and the point source searches that we have recently announced from the collaboration. Just to get everything oriented correctly, one person's signal in this experiment is another person's background. As I mentioned, you can use atmospheric neutrinos produced in cosmic ray showers to do really wonderful physics, but those atmospheric neutrinos are backgrounds to the astrophysical neutrinos that we're actually looking for in the detector. Quite simply, things that we see coming up in the detector and interacting nearby or within it are wonderful golden events. The Earth filters everything else, and so your upgoing events are sort of your bread and butter for the signal that you're looking for. But we have developed techniques where we can actually look up into the sky of the southern hemisphere and cut back the backgrounds that you would ultimately be dominated with otherwise. Okay, so I'll take you through a few of the results. The first comes from what we call the high energy starting event search. And what we do here is we're trying to eliminate the backgrounds from, in particular, from downgoing muons. When a muon passes through the detector, of course, it'll deposit light and you'll see that light. So what we do is we use the outer region of the detector as an active veto. If we see light in that veto region, we eliminate it and we say this is not an event that we're interested in. And we look for events that start in the fiducial regions that are outlined here and here. and we eliminate this fuzzy gray region, which is the dust layer that we discovered, and it basically separates our detector into two halves. And so we perform this search, and these are the first two events that showed up. They're the highest energy neutrino events that were ever recorded above the PEV scale, which is really quite remarkable when you think about it. And we gave them appropriate names. We called them Bert and Ernie for the two highest energy neutrinos detected at that time. And if you take Bert and you bring Bert to the Toronto shoreline, it basically encompasses multiple lengths of the sky dome and fully the height of the CN Tower. These are absolutely enormous events. This is why you have to build a detector at the cubic kilometer scale. If you want to capture enough information to identify your interaction as at the PEV scale, this is the size that energy deposition occurs. Okay.
Was that particular one completely enclosed in the detector, or do you have just a lower bound as to what the energy was?
So Bert was basically fully contained. Yeah. Bert started well inside of the detector, and you can see at the edges the energy has fallen off, and so it was basically a fully contained event. Yeah, in this particular case, Big Bird joined us about a year after Bert and Ernie. There's now 120 high energy neutrinos above the 60 TeV threshold. We ran out of Muppets. We stopped naming them in that case. What you see is exactly what you would expect. You see the background expectation in the blue, the red, and the hashed regions from the different background sources that you would anticipate. And what you see is this beautiful spectrum of the high energy neutrinos above that background expectation. It now exceeds, I believe, 7 sigma in terms of the null hypothesis that it's due to a background source. And so this is clearly from an astrophysical source outside of the interactions that are occurring in the Earth and in the local solar system. The energies are too low there for the sun, for instance, to produce neutrinos at these energies. So put another way, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Can you show that previous slide again?
Yeah.
So should we be reading the last two crosses as being that you had a power law, but then all of a sudden it's flattening out at the highest energies?
These two here?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, sorry, could you ask again?
It looks like you have a nice power law.
Yeah.
And it seems like it's now flattening out.
Okay, yeah, so that's a great question. We don't know if there's a break in the spectrum at this point in time. You can fit this to a single power law, and it will fit quite well, okay? You can also fit it to a broken power law, and you get a good fit there. They're equally good. The statistics aren't there yet to separate that, and that's something that we're working on. Yeah. You can take that data and you can plot it instead as the events, the number of events in the data set for 2,000 plus days above 60 TeV versus the zenith angle. And so zero is your horizon. These are the upgoing events, these are the downgoing events. And you can see this flat spectrum as you expect them to cut off in terms of your background. So this is an extremely robust astrophysical flux of neutrinos that you have from this particular search. This is an event that showed up relatively recently. We were really quite excited about it. It is a cascade type event. Its best estimate is just under 6 PeV in energy. This is the sweet spot for what you would expect for the glass shell resonance, where you would have an anti-electron neutrino interacting with an electron, and it occurs at the 6.3 PeV is the W resonance for that production. So you expect enhancement for neutrino interactions at these energies. So this is basically a confirmation that you would, that as for astrophysical neutrinos that you would see such events start to show up in the data set, given the time exposure which has occurred. Now, the second search that we perform is completely complementary. Instead of looking at the high energy starting events, what we do is we look at upgoing tracks in the detector. And when we look at that flux of events, this was actually the highest energy event that we had observed to date. It had deposited just under 3 PeV of energy in the detector. It's a track event, so the muon exited here and carried more energy out. So when you do a best fit for the total energy of the event based on what was deposited in the detector as it traversed Ice Cube, it's just under 9 PeV. Now, I say was because we sent an alert just 2 weeks ago for an event, same, very similar, high energy track-like event, but the deposited energy was about 5.5 PeV. And so it would exceed this total energy by a significant amount. These upgoing tracks, we can characterize the measurement of their flux. So this is rate versus energy. As the detector was growing in size from 59 strings to 79 strings to the complete detector, and then multiple years of the complete detector. And again, what you see is this flux of events that are pulling out at the highest energies is essentially a bump that you would expect for the astrophysical neutrino signal. And the best fit from the complete combined data is shown in this error bar, in this band here, for the flux of upgoing muon neutrino events. And this exceeds more than 6 sigma from the null hypothesis that there are no astrophysical neutrinos. So again, a complementary measurement through a different channel in Ice Cube that basically tells us that we have an astrophysical flux of neutrinos. Now, if I take my high energy starting events and I take my through-going track events band and I put them on a plot of energy versus the flux, again, normalized to an e to the 2 power spectrum, what you see is really quite remarkable. This is the spectrum that you get of diffuse gamma rays measured with the Fermi detector. These are the cosmic ray spectrum that you get from some of the most recent leading detectors, the TA and the Auger experiment. And then these are the neutrinos that you're measuring with an estimate of our upper limit for when you go to extremely high energies. And what's wonderful is that they basically all fall on the same at the same level. And so there's a connection here, which was always expected to occur, but it's starting to emerge, the connection between these three sources. You can look at the flavor composition of these events. Keep in mind that based on the shape, the topology that you measure, you can tell the different types apart. And so you can measure directly if you're measuring muon, electron, and tau type neutrinos. And you can map the flux that you're measuring back onto what we call a flavor triangle, where you can test the models of what's being produced at the sources, whether they're muon suppressed source, whether you have muon and pion decay occurring at the source, or whether you're source is dominated by neutron decay, for instance, and so you would have completely either electron-type neutrinos or fully muon-type neutrinos in the production or some mix. And then as they propagate from their source to where they're detected, you have neutrino oscillations that basically move them to different locations and near the center of the triangle. If you start out, for instance, with a 1-2 ratio of electron to muon type, it moves here to the center where you expect basically a 1-1-1 ratio measurement of the different flavors once they reach the Earth. Now, we've performed this measurement over a number of years, and this is where we were just over 2.5-3 years ago. What we saw are these contours here in white, the 68 and the 95% sensitivity, with the best fit that was occurring in that regime. And this is open here because we had seen 0 tau neutrino candidates in the data set. Tau neutrinos are not produced in the atmospheric interactions that we have at these energies. And so the tau neutrinos are considered a smoking gun signature for the astrophysical neutrinos. So you would certainly hope that they would be there in the data set that you're looking at. And they have shown up in just the last year and a half. These two events have shown up in our data set in the steady progression of the analyses that we're performing. The two events fall into categories where you have a double cascade signature in the waveforms that you're measuring. And you can see those here. Basically, the event doesn't look like the double bang that I showed you with the large separation, but in the waveforms for a large number of the photomultiplier tubes, you see these two beautiful peak structures separated in time. That's exactly what you would expect from a double cascade event. And so these are the first two tau candidates that we have identified in the data set to date. When you add those into the flavor triangle mix, you can see that you start to close off the tau and your best fit points move towards the center, which is exactly what you would have anticipated would occur at the end of the day. And so this is a wonderful progression for the measurements that are occurring with IceQ.
So okay. The take-home message there is that which of those options were you favoring? The pionic or the neutronic or the mix of the two?
I think it's, yeah. So here right now, I think it's still hard to tell. This contour needs to shrink so that you can separate between these three points here. So our contour still encloses basically all three. I think this one is starting to fall out of favor. You're starting to remove the neutron decay case as a dominant source. Yeah. Okay. So then the natural question is, where are they coming from? And so if you look back at the night sky, in terms of neutrinos, this is what you see from the IceCube data at the moment. We look at the hottest spots in the sky from both the north and the southern hemisphere, and we do that both in a through-going track search and in the high-energy starting event search. So these events are above 60 TeV, and these events are above about 10 TeV in energy. And so what you see is really quite remarkable. It's like a time-lapsed exposure of a photograph. Things are starting to pop out in terms of looking back at the sky. In the northern hemisphere in particular, the hottest spot in the sky at the moment is nearly directly on target with the Messier object M77. This is a spiral bar galaxy. It's an active galactic nuclei, so it has a supermassive black hole at the center of that spiral bar galaxy. And we see that at the 3 sigma level, taking all the trial penalties for the look elsewhere effect, this is actually starting to get interesting. Southern hemisphere, there's no specific object in our catalog at the moment that registers in that particular location, but it is a lower significance than what we have in the northern sky, and that's just because it's harder to look to the southern sky, because keep in mind that would be looking above the horizon at the neutrinos that are coming down into the detector.
Is this right ascension declination?
Yeah.
Exactly. Is that curve the solar system, or is that the galactic plane?
This is the galactic plane. Yeah. I know what you're doing there. Yeah, and we look for whether there's correlations, for instance, with the galactic plane, and in particular with the galactic center. The galactic center is above our horizon. It's harder for us to look there, and so. What I'll tell you is that this is not yet significant. Yeah. Okay, so this is where I would usually have ended my talk. But then September 2017, this event arrived. And what you see is this really beautiful track that went through the detector. Again, red is early, blue is late. It's an upward going muon neutrino event. It reconstructs with an energy of 300 TeV. The direction and energy is right in the sweet spot of IceCube's sensitivity in terms of where it can look in the sky for astrophysical events. About a year and a half before this event arrived, we started sending messages to the astronomical community when events like this showed up in our detector. And so we sent a GCN circular out to the world, and the world looked in that spot and they actually saw something. What they found was a blazar, a supermassive black hole with a jet, and that jet is basically aligned with the direction of the Earth. And so you're basically beaming your particle acceleration directly towards the Earth in that particular orientation. And really quite remarkably, the blazar in particular was in a very active state. Blazars spend a large fraction of their time that we've measured them in quiescence. They're in a quiet mode. This blazar, as you'll see in a couple of slides, was really in a quite remarkable state. The observations around the globe and in space were followed up by more than 20 observatories. 20 of these observatories saw positive detections from that blazar during the period of time following when we sent the neutrino alert. The two that I will point out are from the Fermilat telescope in space and the MAGIC telescope on Earth. Fermilat is sensitive to high energy gamma rays, and MAGIC is sensitive to very high energy gamma rays up to the TeV scale. And you can see the significances of the error count. So this is the error contour for IceCube. This is the pointing resolution for the Fermilat telescope. And they basically exceed 5-6 sigma in both cases. Again, with the MAGIC telescope, this is their data set on the color map, and very high sensitivity significance measurement of very high energy gamma rays coming from that blazar during this period of time following the arrival of the neutrino alert that we sent out. If you look at the information that was collected from the blazar's direction following the IceCube alert, which shows at this dotted line, this is the broadband spectrum from gamma ray all the way to radio, including X-ray measurements that occurred from SWIFT and then the optical band that you see here. And you can see the historical data. And so this is, for instance, is the Fermi data all the way back to before 2009. And you can see that this blazar is essentially in a quiet state. And in about April that of 2017, it turned up. That's a factor of 6 over its previous activity during this period. And the neutrino arrives here during that peak period in the blazar's activity. Okay. The question that we often get is how often does why this blazar, and then B, what is the probability that this happens by chance? So to answer the first question, this blazar is really quite special. If you look at the time averaged luminosity from the blazar TXS0506, or Texas as we call it, it's an order of magnitude above the brightest objects in the sky that we have constantly looked at in our catalog and not yet seen neutrinos from. Markarian 421-501, for instance. How often does it happen by chance? If you look just at the straight correlation for high energy and very high energy gamma rays in this part of the sky with a neutrino arriving during that episodic period, it's about 4.1 sigma. If you take the look elsewhere effect and the previous alerts that we sent out, you take a penalty factor for that, and so the correlated emission is about 3 sigma preference for this to have occurred. Okay. And then we went back and we looked in our data in this point of the sky because something drove us to do that. And we looked at 9.5 years of IceCube data. And what we saw was really quite remarkable. This is the September 22, 2017 event. This is the neutrino flare that occurred in late 2014, early 2015, over a 5-month period. We saw 13 events. We saw 18 events when we expected 5 from background in that period. And you can see in the animation here the spot becomes warm, and then it drives to a very high intensity of neutrinos, and then it fades out, and it goes back into a quiet period until the high energy neutrino arrived a few years later. The probability for this occurring, this is about 3.5 sigma. So it is a robust, it's really an intriguing neutrino flare that occurred a few years before we were pointed there from the September 22 event. Okay.
No photons at that.
So yeah, so if you look at, so this was before we had real-time follow-up, and but Fermi is always looking at the sky. It does a full sky sweep every few hours. The blazar in 2015 is here in the Fermi data. So there's no enhanced gamma ray emission, at least in the high energy gamma rays. It's hard to tell what may have been in the other parts of the spectrum. Okay. So last summer, it was fun. We had, we released the results. Cover of Science was given for the result. Three major press conferences occurred to cover this story, more than 2,000 articles in that day when the news was released. And late in the year, building attention. This is one of the favorite headlines from Vox that I copied. I just love that. Okay. And so this is where we are today. And this is my motto in life. Anything worth doing is worth overdoing. It comes from one of the world's foremost sources, Mick Jagger. And this is what we're aiming towards. So what we want to do is increase the sensitivity of an ice cube by an order of magnitude. And that means 120 new strings distributed over basically a 10 cubic kilometer volume in the deep glacier. We call it Generation 2. We shortened that to Gen 2 because there's a Gen 2 penguin, so that's our mascot, which seems completely appropriate. And we're building this. We've just been fully approved last year to build phase one for this, and that's seven new strings in the deep ice. And so you can see that here. This is the Gen 2 array in the light green that we want to achieve, filling in this entire space. The starting point is zooming into Ice Cube and then zooming in again to the center of Ice Cube where we have deep core. The red dots are the seven new strings of instrumentation that we want to deploy. In particular, what we're aiming to do is a precision calibration program that allows us to do much better pointing with the cascade events, for instance. If you can achieve this approximate factor of 6 improvement in your reconstruction, you can basically double the current data set that IceCube has already taken in the last 9 years. And then with the full Gen 2 detector, what happens is really quite amazing. This is the band that you saw of the through going muon events and then the Hesse events. The error bars get absolutely tiny in the regime above about 10 to 30 TeV, and then as you go to the extremely high energies, you should be, we would be sensitive to neutrinos at energies that basically align with the cosmic rays that are being produced. And so you reach out into the ultra high energy regime. When you do that, your pointing resolution for these events, your sensitivity to point sources increases by nearly a full order of magnitude. Okay, so in summary, we've moved from the era of discovery to astronomy. This is one of our winter overs, watching one of the most intense auroras that we had in the last winter season. This is how I like to think we actually do our astronomy, but it's not. We've discovered an extremely robust high energy neutrino flux coming to us from the universe, and the energy density for that neutrino flux is very similar to what we're seeing in gamma rays and cosmic rays. And this is intriguing because this is what was predicted would ultimately be achievable with such a detector. neutrinos entered the game of multi-messenger astronomy. There was a broadband multi-wavelength follow-up of our September event, and that's the first evidence for a cosmic ray accelerator that we have. So that's a beautiful step forward for the program. And that global program is growing. The building of the detectors is underway, including the new upgrade to the IceCube detector. And this is really, this has opened a new window for which we can study the extreme universe. And I'll thank you and take questions.
Questions from the students for Derek?
It's probably a very naive question, but why a hexagon?
Sorry?
Why a hexagon?
Why the hexagon? Great question. It optimizes, when IceCube was designed, the knowledge of the deep ice wasn't well known, okay? So what you wanted to do was optimize the distance between strings that would allow you to target the energy range where the models were favored, yeah? And so this is the tens of TeV up into the PeV scale. So based on the best knowledge of the ice, so the Amanda detector was deployed more shallow than IceCube. That gave us information to about a kilometer and a half into the glacier. And we used that to extrapolate what we could expect the deep ice optical properties to be. So when you do that, you have about 125 meters was the estimated best distance between strings for the spacing, and then the hexagon is a good packing fraction in that arrangement. Yeah.
I'm not a student, but sorry.
So is it possible to measure a cross-correlation on the sky between your events and galaxies or AGN?
It's exactly what we do. So basically, what you do is you identify a catalog of sources, AGN, gamma ray bursts, for instance. Although gamma ray bursts are transients, AGN are sort of a steady state that you could expect to be a constant producer. You identify, I think our current catalog is something like 110 objects across the sky. And we look for, what we do is we look for correlations in, we look for correlations in terms of the number of neutrinos and their energy across that sky, right?
Is your cross-correlating, you said, with like 100 objects?
Yeah, and so you take a heavy penalty.
The number of galaxies is more than 100.
No, you're right. So every time you add an object, you take a penalty in terms of the significance if you see something in that part of the sky. And so you're selective in terms of what you do is you pick out objects that are favored cosmic ray accelerating sources, yeah? And so you choose things like the Markarian objects, the Messier object, like M77. These are known to be high energy gamma ray emitters, for instance. And so you're using that information to drive where you look in the sky for the correlation.
Right, but it might be interesting to look for sources that you might not have.
Absolutely, yeah. No, yeah, you're absolutely right. So for instance, the TXS source, the Texas source, is let me think, see if I can find it. It's right about here. And it's a little orange dot in our sky map, yeah? It wasn't in our catalog before the event in September of 2017. And it is in the catalog now, of course. But and so those are how you start to add in, you know, it's the new information that you use to start to add in those sources. Yeah.
Question.
lengths, the longest tracks you could expect to see, you expect 10K, is that going to capture them, or are there at the higher energies even longer tracks? Like, what's the upper limit on the?
Yeah, great question. So let me think. I don't have it in my backup slides. At multi-TeV, so at 100 TeV, the track length for the muon is something on the order of about, it's between 5 and 10 kilometers. And so once you go to about 10 times the volume, you wouldn't quite capture all of it. I think the longest distance here, this is about 6 kilometers in length. And so if you had a nearly horizontal event traveling through that path, you would capture most of it, but you would miss it. It would still escape. Yeah.
Even much higher energy events.
Yeah.
We're talking length of the Earth or?
No, not quite length of the Earth, but it could. So as you go to, let me see what I want to do here. Yeah. So as you go to higher energies, you don't chase those with the optical Cherenkov method. It becomes inefficient. And so what you see in this image surrounding the optical detector, these are radio detectors. There's a beautiful complementarity where the optical efficiency deploying optical Cherenkov detectors falls off at about, I want to get it right, it's about 30 PeV. And above 30 PeV is where the Askarian effect in the atmosphere boosts the radio signal from the neutrino interacting in ice. And so what you have is essentially you complement the two technologies. So you use the optical array to look for events up to about 30 PeV, 100 PeV, and then the radio array takes over at about 100 PeV and above. And that's how you would ultimately measure the ultra high energy neutrinos.
What was it? You said the Askarian effect? What's the Askarian effect?
Yeah, so Askarian is he postulated that when a neutrino interacts in a medium, that you get a boost in the radio frequencies that are produced, and it works. And so this was observed first in a measurement, I think it was at SLAC. They built a trial for this, and it's real. And so there are radio arrays. One is called ARA. It's deployed in situ with there's three stations currently operating in situ with the IceCube detector array. And so you can use that to look for. When you have a very high interaction, you can use that to look for the neutrino interaction, but in the radio frequency. Yeah.
So this is like Cherenkov radiation, but in radio wave.
Yeah. I think that's the right way to think about it. Yeah. I can send you the paper. It's actually a lot of fun. Yeah. Yeah.
Just a separate question, if I can. I don't know if. So the plot you had of the Fermi spectrum and the neutrino being similar, that sounds like that's saying something like whatever is making the neutrinos is making photons, so that's like protons hitting things and pions, and you had that plot.
That's right, yeah. It all goes back to the, yeah.
So it disfavors electrons being accelerated. So have things been settled out as to, is there a kind of a consensus emerging around what the process is that makes these cosmic waves? Because I know that there's all these models like shock waves are accelerating things,
Is
there a consensus or
no? I don't think there is. It gets harder. If I have it, yeah. So when you look at the flux of the particles that are measured, so photons, this is across the energy spectrum, right? This is what they see in terms of the spectral energy distribution for the Texas, the blazar that was studied following the September event. Yeah. And so you can see the measurements from each of the experiments across this energy range from optical all the way into the gamma rays up here. And this is the limit from the neutrino measurements associated with the source. That the challenge is how do you fit the expectation from the neutrinos with that from the optical and from the gamma ray. And what you find is that it doesn't fit the models. In particular, the lack of the gamma ray of higher gamma ray activity in 2014 makes this really challenging. And so I think that, you know, the short answer is that there's not yet consensus. In fact, I think there's more confusion than clarity at this point in time for the model builders. That's my naive statement.
As you see more and more, this might be something blocking the gamma rays or something for that.
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah, they could be quenched, or there could be some other model that's occurring at that particular point in time, where the gamma rays are either absorbed or not being produced. Yeah, and I think these are the types of things that have to be sorted. Yeah, but you know, ideally you would have more events to work with than just the one, and that's what we're working towards. Yeah.
Bistro staff have set out some snacks for us on the first floor of the bistro, so we can have a chance to ask more questions there.
Thanks.